You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Gorilla Share. It's common form to start interviews with cricketers with some career statistics. Let me assure you that today I'm with a former player who has some very good ones as part of the all-conquering Warwickshire side, the 1990s under Bob Woolmer. However, he holds the US Certificate of Appreciation for his groundbreaking work using cricket as a force for good with the gangs in the most notorious areas of Los Angeles. He advises The Prince's Trust, is a motivational speaker and broadcaster and a published author whose book, Wasted, was described by one reviewer thus: not so much a kiss and tell as kiss, have casual sex, get stoned, drunk, divorced, unemployed, homeless, penniless, and then tell. Although written 12 years ago, it is a rattling good read, but it also contains thought-provoking wisdom born out of experience. Life, says its author, is a work in progress. Life gave its author a second chance, which he continues to grab. Paul Smith.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for hosting us today, because we are here at Edgbaston in your room. So I'm welcoming you to our show. You are, in fact, our host.
Welcome.
So
welcome to my room.
Welcome to your room. Now, one of the themes that you recurs throughout the book is around confidence and purpose. You say it's something that you need in all aspects of life. Tell us just a little bit in your way of thinking about life and cricket. Why are you focused so much on those two thoughts in the book?
Confidence and purpose. Well, from a sports perspective, that when you're confident and you understand your purpose, then that's probably when you'll get your best results, or it's certainly when you'll be able to analyse how things are going, and either put them right you'll be able to put them right better if you have those two things. And if you're lacking in them, then you have to need to grasp them fairly quickly in order to turn that corner. I think in everyday life, the people that I've met who've lacked confidence and purpose needed the most guidance. Often that's the excluded. They could be of all age groups, and sometimes people driving around in the best cars, wearing the best suits, also lack confidence and purpose. So I think it's about identifying what you think your purpose is, what you think you can do to take things forward, and will make you and those around you more confident, and that would lead to a better future all round.
Well, it's one of the things that, given the work you've done linked to cricket but imparting cricket, that I wanted to sort of talk to you about, was how do you think it comes to light in your activities now, and particularly how do you impart that to others?
If you talk about working with, you talk about community work, and I think the more that you can give confidence to people, often people know what they actually want to do, but no one's actually sort of planted that seed in them that they actually can achieve that. And often the system will try and funnel you down the same places that everyone else is, because that ultimately comes down to figures. So if I were to turn around to you and say, right, I want you to go and work in an office for the rest of your life down the road, you'll be there from 8:45 in the morning till 5:15. In many cases, I know that situation has been forced upon people because that's all about employment figures, when in fact I know that within 3 days they're going to be ringing me saying, this is the last thing on earth I think that I'm going to be able to do. So I would always say, don't put yourself in a situation where you know it's not going to work. I would always say, hang on a bit longer and try and find the opening that you're actually going to fulfill you. It leads to a happier society.
So are you finding now that are you still involved in people development with cricket as the core of kind of your doing that? Or have you moved beyond cricket just to where people development is the kind of the main raison d'etre for what you do?
I would, probably in the last couple of years, I've been more of an advisor, more than a hands-on one. I'll give you an example of that. In the west end of Newcastle, my city of my birth, I've got a pal who has done amazing work for the best part of 40 years within the community, most of it not really acknowledged. However, in more recent times, he's been involved with Chance to Shine right at the top. He wanted to put on an activity where it involved asylum seekers, the children of asylum seekers. It involved young kids who got too much time on their hands, too much time has been taken up by police officers, community workers, the court systems, etc., etc. So it's costing the city of Newcastle an absolute fortune. And he picked my brains about work that I'd done in townships in Soweto, and that townships such as Soweto under apartheid, and then how further down the road, say Bob Woolmer and I did a lot of work in townships during the dismantling of apartheid. So the art of communication, it wasn't just about bat and ball, it was about gaining confidence, it was about getting people to think differently, and where the outcomes had to be different. If you talk about working in places like Compton or South Central or Inglewood or Watson, places in the States, ultimately it's not, you're not looking to turn someone into the next Freddie Flintoff or Ian Botham, or, you know, obviously there's more recent versions of those guys. It's not about turning them into that, but that would be a real bonus. It's about getting people to change their behaviour. So in the northeast of England, a guy called Russell Perry picked my brains. What have the outcomes got to be? We worked, I told him, if you want these outcomes, this is the sort of funding that you have to seek. You're not going to get sporting funding for it, because that's not what the initial target is going to be. Over a two-year period, he's completely transformed a community in the west end of Newcastle where you're probably saving millions in court costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in more recent times, Chance to Shine have jumped on the back of that. So it'll be seen to be a chance to shine project. But in theory, the guy that's actually done all the work is a guy called Russell Perry. So that's just one example.
Did it have a cricket connection prior to your involvement in terms of a project? Or was it, is it a community project that has embraced cricket along the way?
There was no project. There was no activity going on. He identified a part of the city where you would repeatedly read and hear about some pretty negative activity taking place. And he picked my brains as to whether I thought that was the sort of, because we know the city well, whether that was the sort of place where maybe some sort of activity should take place. So between the pair of us, we worked out what could take place, and then he did all the footwork himself. And as activities gain some sort of momentum, then what happens is, if you get a few people coming this week, then hopefully if you can get, it's about giving people a good time, making them understand that you are there for them. And maybe they'll bring a few more mates next week, and then maybe they'll bring a few more. You'll lose a few along the way. Mm-hmm. But by and large, what you do is you gain the confidence of people within that community. People will become aware of the fact that these young people are not involved in acts of crime as they were up until relatively recent. That will then attract the attention of police forces, because they'll see that whatever's taking place is starting to work. You then get parents actually supporting it, because they can see that their kids are not getting into trouble. And before you know it, within maybe 12 months, within 2 years, you've actually got a real hive of activity. And, you know, hopefully it's acknowledged. And thankfully for Russell, it has been acknowledged.
One of the things you talk a lot about in the book is how cricket as a game offers many opportunities to teach people skills that go way beyond cricket. I mean, you cite the example of simply communication skills and trust if you're two batsmen working together. And that seems to have been a consistent theme for your work in the UK with the Prince's Trust, and when you went to Los Angeles and worked in, sort of, as you say, into Compton, Inglewood and South Central, and, you know, some of the Crips gangs, you know, the worst gangs out there. And what is it, do you think, that uniquely enables cricket to have that capacity?
Well, cricket will teach you how to work in pairs. It'll teach you how to understand team strategy. It'll improve maths. It'll teach. In life, lots of people look, but not many people see. With sport, or particularly cricket, it's very visual, and it's easy. If you're smart, you can teach people a lot just by saying, watch this, watch that. It makes people more observant. Cricket has so many, there's so much more to it than bat and ball. It teaches people patience. I think the key, if you talk about community activities, and you talk about people who, in this day and age where most people are used to being able to get results in the, you know, with the blink of an eye, mobile phones or computers being a classic example, you know you Google something, the assumption is the answer is that it's absolutely correct. The thing with cricket is you can do absolutely everything right and still not get the results, and that actually teaches young people an awful lot.
Kind of fortitude and...
Well, resilience is hugely important. The fact that the game lasts as long as it does sometimes is a disadvantage in the modern world where everyone wants results in split seconds. However, it means that you are engaged with teammates and opponents for far longer, and there's many success stories. It gives you longer. The longer you spend together, hopefully the longer the bond is, the better the bond is.
The type of skill or coach that it takes to do that is not the traditional going into a public school and teaching cricket. Sure. It takes a different set of skills. Given that vision for the ability of cricket to impact those kind of communities and be that force for good and actually to turn lives around, what do you think differentiates someone best to communicate that from a typical cricket coach?
Well, a classic example. Well, no, it's not a classic example. If you think about Bob Woolmer, when he was coach here, he asked me to go to a cricket club in South Africa called St. Augustine's. Mm. St. Augustine's is Basil de Oliveira's cricket club in Cape Town. In their whole existence, they'd never been allowed to play against white teams, which is why Basil came across here, to give himself an even chance of being able to progress as a sportsman and hopefully being able to go further up the ladder, which he did, obviously, by playing cricket for England. But Bob Woolmer said to me, I want you to come to Cape Town, city I'd been to many times. I want you to come to Cape Town. I want you to be the professional for a team called St. Augustine's. And your job is to move the club, but more importantly, the community forward. It's about much more than bat and ball and how many runs or wickets that you actually get. And at 6 months after I'd agreed to do that, at the end of that summer, he and I sat down in his garden and I asked him why he'd asked me specifically to go and do that job. And he said because he knew how difficult it was going to be, because all my teammates, I used to be racially abused for being white playing in a team of non-white people.
Am I right in saying you were the first, or indeed the only white player to play for that club?
Yeah, I was the first white player ever to play for St. Augustine's, the first ever professional. And it was a hard gig. I mean, great people, great friendships to this day. We keep in touch all the time. I think probably it's become more apparent the work that that was actually taking place then, without sort of pulling my own wire. It was arguably the biggest opening of my eyes that I'd ever seen, and I thought I'd seen a lot. You know, I'd coached in South Africa in townships under apartheid, but this was actually the dismantling of it, where I would be racially abused by white people on the field asking me why I was playing in a team full of coloured people. What that actually did with me and my teammates is it made us grow stronger and stronger by the day. And if you were to speak to people at the club now in 2019, you'd actually get a fair indication of what we'd gone through. But these people, you know, had never been able to go into certain parts of town because they weren't the right colour. When we played cricket at Newlands, it was a pretty humbling experience for them because they'd never been able to go to the ground at Newlands and set foot on it. And I saw firsthand in our changing room what this was all about. It was a pretty humbling experience. So in many ways, my job was to go and run up and hit as many opponents as hard as I could with a cricket ball for what had taken place. Mm. Over generations, as it was to try and pull off as many results. But, you know, we couldn't play any of our games at home because the council, which was still a white council, they refused to cut the grass on the ground, despite the fact it was a council ground. There was a dispute going on, and didn't matter how many meetings or how many phone calls that got put in, it was just never going to happen. So we had to play all our games away from home. So when you've gone through all those sorts of experiences and people talk about trivial things that take place within sport, what you're actually doing is changing a culture. Mm. So how cricket transcends into everyday life and how you can change people's lives, that's a classic example that hopefully will be broadcast a bit more further down the line.
Fantastic. So, well, let's talk a little bit about your career then and some of the influences. You've just been talking about Bob Woolmer.
Sure.
And in Wasted, you talk about influences on your career. You speak in glowing terms of him, obviously a very, very sad loss under terrible circumstances. Tell us a little bit about the man then and how he influenced you and kind of led you through the ups and downs of life generally, not just cricket.
Sure. I actually coached with Woolly in Johannesburg when I was an 18-year-old kid. he was very, very close with to Dr. Ali Bakker, and Bakker was trying to break down as many barriers as possible. So that would mean coaching in Soweto. So I would coach in Soweto. Bob would be up seeing Dr. Ali Bakker, and he would come into Soweto. Further down the line, I reminded Bob that I had coached with him in Soweto, and he said, yeah, I remember, you were an 18-year-old who was always out on the town drinking beer and this, that, and the other. So that was my immediate impression with Bob. Probably when we met further down the line and he came to Warwickshire, he probably thought I was just a slightly older version of what he'd thought I was when I was 18. Bob's impact here at Edgbaston was massive. When he first came, on his very first day, he said, if I can make you 5% better people, you'll become better cricketers. And I remember sitting in that meeting and thinking, that's a really interesting way of sort of putting something across. He always thought outside the box. He would always be curious as to how we could do things that opponents wouldn't spot, or if they had spotted it, it was too late. We were already all over them. He always encouraged you to develop different skills, to be better at the ones that you had. It was always important to him, not only just to practice the things that you were trying to improve on, but to continually practice the things that you were very good at, so that when you did something well, you knew why you'd done it well. And obviously, at the same time, you're trying to improve on your weaknesses. And over time, if you practice enough and you give it enough thought, you'll be a much more dominant player.
So, he coached you through that. It was 94 treble season, I think. Was it 95 double season as well?
Well, he came in 1991, and I'm pretty sure he left at the end of 1994 to become the South African coach. In 95, Phil Neal was a coach here, and we did a double. But, I mean, in theory, we were such a dominant group of people, never mind a dominant group of players. Between 91 and in the end of 94, that journey, that was 4 summers that he was here. Physically and mentally, it was probably the equivalent of 8 summers, because of everything that actually went on. We trained harder than anyone else. Obviously, the more successful you become, the more time you actually spend on the field or practicing before those big games. And the greater demands of you as a person, that eats into your social life, because the more successful you become, the more demands there are on you as a person to attend functions and celebrations and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's again something that I think is quite interesting, because you kind of, it's almost as if, paraphrase. Or the tremolos, even the bad times are good. It's almost like even the good times can be bad, because one of the things you do talk about is so much demand, the intensity of playing the game, the demands on your personal time. If it isn't playing, it's club business, and almost that sense of untouchability and invincibility that works against where you go when that stops, that leaves you at a point, when the career folds down, it kind of led you for a while in your life, didn't it, into probably potentially sense of lacking direction and feeling kind of a little bit bereft for what you'd lost, as it were.
I think when I came here as a young kid, maybe naively, I looked at what I was watching, and obviously you had Willis, you had Calacharan, you had your Ramuses, you had some fantastic players who were floating around. What you actually had was that, bear in mind, this is a 14-year-old kid thinking this. I thought that there could be, I didn't understand why the team didn't win more. And then the more you watch, the more maybe you understand the fact that the reason that the team didn't win as much is, I'm not saying there's a split camp, but you've got batters who think one thing and you've got bowlers that think another. I remember distinctly, much as the same as when I met Willis when I was nine, and I think I want to play in the same team as you. I remember distinctly, before I signed my very first contract here, thinking that by the time I leave here, I want to have helped turn things around so that it was a dominant force. And by the time I was 30, we'd actually done that. And where you actually go from there is quite an interesting, it's quite an interesting stage of your life. When you've actually set out to achieve, if you're Jimmy Page and you put three guys together with you and you form a band called Led Zeppelin, once you've actually achieved what you've done, where do you go from there? And then Bob went, and I think that was pivotal, because everything changed. Despite the fact that he would always take your calls, he'd always reply to emails and whatever, life goes on. And within a very short period of time, I found my eyes drifting off. I wanted to go to America. It was a completely different part of America I wanted to go and spend time in Texas, which I ultimately did. But yeah, I mean, I think now in 2019, how players are looked after is probably very, very different to what it was in the latter stages of my career. Whether it's done correctly now in 2019, I don't know. Things like a players' union advice and things like that, whether they do it right or wrong is open for debate as well.
Well, that again is one of the things I wanted to sort of chat to you about is, you know, in the November issue, I think, of The Cricketer, you wrote the open letter to Alex Hales. And you were very encouraging, whilst also chastising to a degree, but encouraging, in pointing him in directions of ways he could move himself forward. It wasn't critical. It was understanding, empathetic, but also directional in terms of ways he could address that. Has he responded in any way to that article, just out of interest? And you may not want to answer that. You may want to keep that between you if he has, but I'm curious to know.
I haven't heard anything from Alex Hales. I wouldn't expect to hear anything from Alex Hales. I'm not the easiest person to get hold of, to be fair. Although certain people at Notts who were affiliated with Notts, I've had a couple of people contact me from them, but they're not necessarily named people within their system. I think ultimately what happened with him, with me, I think that if you, how can I put it? If you have someone sat in front of you that you know there are issues in their life, I think it's absolutely crucial to be able to relate to them. You see, I deal with life experiences. I would always deal with the person who sat in front of me. I'm not saying you're trying to play the role of a psychologist, but if you have been in a position where your job is a very public one, you have a lot of people who would want to attach themselves to you because you are a well-known person. You may spend a lot of time on TV. You may be a personality of such. If you are an outgoing person, sometimes the temptations that are all around us are right, you know, literally put in the palm of your hand. So he'd obviously fallen into a certain sort of situation in his life where within professional sport it's seen to be the Antichrist, despite the fact that there are people from every walk of life who were doing exactly the same things. I wrote that article in the manner that I did, in open letter form to Alex Hales, because if anything, it would open up a way of thought for a reader. I mean, the easiest thing for Alex Hales and someone like myself to have a conversation is for someone to pick up a phone. What I was actually saying is, I've been there, done that. If you keep doing things the same way that you always have, the same situations will always keep arising. Where you say, you know, the people that you surround yourself with can make or break your career, and the people that judge you within the sport, they don't really want you around too much because they talk about sponsors, they talk about this, they talk about partners and whatever. When in theory, without the likes of Alex Hales, you might not have sponsors, you might not have this, that and the other. You talk about a very disruptive person on the field, we're not all the same. Ian Botham used to say, you can't expect me to go home to my hotel room and wrap myself up in cotton wool when you see the way that... Well, that is, you know, there's huge amounts of truth in that. So that's the why I wrote it in the manner that I did. I could have written it in a completely different way, which would maybe not have the same impact.
One of the things that I'd say quite impressed me about it was very, what's the word, the right word, kind of collegiate. So it wasn't, as I say, critical in any way. You actually named people, like the coach at, who's going to be, was it the Notts Outlaws? No, sure. Whatever they're calling the 100 yeah. outfit in Trent Bridge. You pointed him in the direction of people you knew Stephen Fleming, who had trodden a similar path or had similar issues, because you knew the opportunity would be there. It was almost as if he had come to you and if he had said, I could do with a bit of help, it's almost as he asked you that question, because it was very practical help you were giving him. It wasn't just theory. You were saying, talk to this guy. Talk to that guy. Here is an opportunity. And it was just very encouraging. That's what I thought. It was quite a warm article to read, because it the criticism was there, but giving him the tools with which to set himself on the right course was also there. And I thought that was quite powerful, the way it was done, to be honest.
But you see, to me, that's quite obvious. But then you're talking to someone who has seen certain things in life. So a certain type of person... At times in life, when someone has done wrong, they get a figure of authority put in front of them. There is a discussion that takes place where the person in authority thinks that they're coming from the right angle, when in fact they're probably the last person on earth who should be sat in front of the person who has issues in their life. The assumption also is sometimes is that you bring in a sports psychologist or a psychologist and you sit down with that player, if we're talking about a professional sportsman. And often, yes, of course, they're the right person to be sat in front of. But if you have someone who's been in that very same position, both as a professional sportsman and fallen foul of, maybe in this case you talk about society's evil, maybe they are the perfect person to actually sit with that person and sort of, I'm not saying embrace the circumstances in which you find yourself, but people do find themselves in worse positions than that. We're talking about someone who screwed up and it affected their professional career. Hopefully the short term, he's lucky he got banned for 2 weeks. Mm. And he immediately could walk back into a situation where he could earn handsomely. I think back in the day, what used to happen was there'd be a QC called Gerard Elias, who the ECB used to... And he basically used to sit there as a QC and ban people for 2 years so that you couldn't earn a penny for 2 years.
I think you got the 2-year ban, didn't you? Although it was the end of your career, so it was almost like a...
I'd already retired. I retired because I knew there were issues in my life, and I knew that if I was still in professional sport, it was only going to make them worse. That's why I wanted to go and live in America, so I could sort myself out the way. And situations arose that shouldn't really have arisen. And before I know it, I was sat in front of a QC who banned me for 22 months. So any sort of possibility where I could earn decent money disappeared straight away. That now, further down the line, hopefully the people who are in charge there should realise that that should have been he should have been the last person on earth who should have been sat in front of a professional sportsman. And you know, he made hay whilst the sun shined because he banned loads of people for long periods of time.
Yeah, so that's an area I think well worth exploring in as we chat, I think, because, you know, Alex Hale, certainly. You can also look at cases like Alex Hebborn, Joe Clark, different kind of, you know, wayward behaviour. But young men in a team environment are never going to be angels. And it's never right to expect them to be, or to try and sit on the outside and expect there to be, you know, this kind of like purity of behaviour in young men who have, you know, naturally energy to burn. When you kind of went through those challenges that you had, did you feel that you had enough support and guidance from the club that you represented? Or did you feel that they should have given you more? And do you feel that maybe at today that support and advice is better and more accessible to players?
Support? Support from Warwickshire. I think what actually happened with Warwickshire is I was gone, and then further down the line, when they realised I'd sorted myself out, they then played quite a big part in asking me to get involved in their community activities within this city of Birmingham. So they played a part further down the line. I think from a Professional Cricketers Association point of view, at that time, there was virtually no support in terms of how you can really move forward in life. What the PCA did for me is they dealt with creditors to make sure that I didn't lose a house, so I had that amount of stability. But now I think in this day and age, what you've got is you have situations where before players retire, there is a lot of advice that is on hand, so that, you know, they've got a basic idea of where the support is in the first place. But I think in my day and age, that system wasn't there at all. Don't know if that answers the question or not.
I think it does. I know that having read the book, you went through some pretty tough times. I think you lost the access to your daughter. You lost your wife. Divorce, and then lost the mother of the daughter, weren't able to see the daughter. Clearly the issues with drugs and drink that you fought your way through. And I was just wondering, was there anyone at that time who was able to kind of at least try and help you? Or as you were coming to the end of it, or at the end of your career, were you kind of a little bit cut adrift?
I think cut adrift is probably a fair assessment, but I think if you have a load of issues in your life, anyone who's gone through those things will probably we probably all say you find out who your mates are. Most of the people who were dominant in my life at that time had nothing to do with professional sport, and even to this day, 20 odd years down the line, they're probably people that I'm most close to. They're not people that, even if I named them, you wouldn't know who they are. You know, they don't necessarily live in the best parts of town. They weren't people who could sort of put you up in accommodation or anything like that. They would they knew. They got it. Some of them had been through the very same things. Some of them hadn't gone through the very same things, but I've been able to advise them because they have further down the line in their own lives. Many of the things that I went through, that's why, I ended up working with people who were homeless, because I got it. Many times people said to me, what are you doing here? They couldn't believe that, because they see the public life. They see TV, they see success, they see a lot of different things. They couldn't believe that I was in those circumstances or helping in those places, because at that time of my life, they were the realest people that I could actually ever spend time with, because they were absolutely desperate, and didn't matter to me how desperate I felt. I knew they were in a worse position than me, so at least it was cathartic,
yeah,
if nothing else.
Well, that kind of takes us back a little bit to that whole thought of confidence and purpose, so to sort of regain your confidence and purpose. You hit upon a direction for your career and your life that enabled you to help other people using the skills that you had. And we are going to talk a lot more about that. I guess what I was kind of interested in was the question, though, is where does the responsibility of parochial care of a cricket club who you've played for 12 years, in many cases players play for their whole career.
16.
Where does that necessarily start and stop? I mean, history is littered, sadly, with players who didn't come out the other side. I'm thinking I can go right back to Albert Trott, if you want to, Sid Barnes, Harold Gimlett, Peter Roebuck. You know, they're all people who clearly, for whatever reason or other, didn't come out of the game and figure out things kind of went astray.
More suicides than any other sport.
Yeah. So why is that? And do you feel, and I'm not trying to lead you down a path here, but do you feel clubs should do more to kind of, I guess maybe it's about preparing and giving some initial support to life beyond, you know, what goes on once you've stepped over the white line?
I think cricket clubs are cricket clubs, and we're sat here at Edgbaston. This is a great, great cricket club, but it is a cricket club. And I think that if you look at the history of this place, if you look at the coaching staff, a lot of them are ex-players. There's only so many people can coach. So there's only so many jobs. I think that things like mentoring, bringing ex-players in, should be looked at. And I'm not just talking about Warwickshire here. I'm talking about the whole system. I know that there are ex-sportsmen, there are ex-marines, there's all sorts of people who go into business and give fascinating and, you know, motivational speeches. And that's a part of industry that I explore and have gone and done bits and pieces of work in. But a cricket club is a cricket club. I think the key to it is we are all part of a players' union. I think the players' union have to continually assess everything that they are doing for ex-players. The focus tends to be on the present, but when, you know, there's not many present players take their lives. It tends to be further down the line when people are retired. The issues where you lose the stability of a changing room, of a structure, of a this, that, and the other. It's easy to put your hand up when you're a player and say, I think I've got a problem. It doesn't happen very often because you've actually identified you've got a problem, and then the club has to look at you to see if you are a problem within their very small system. How the players' union advise players and ex-players is absolutely pivotal. And I think it needs constantly assessing the whole time, and any smug element within that system ought to be pinpointed, and doesn't matter who it is, from the top to the bottom, it needs constant scrutiny.
If we take and it was actually kind of interesting in a way that, you know, when I'm looking at articles written about you and about the book, there was kind of a resurgence of interest in a way in 2013, and that was sadly, you know, for the worst of reasons, because of the death of Tom Maynard. And then, you know, there were people, including Mike Atherton, I think, who kind of explored the issues that you went through, and the fact that, you know, nowadays, if we look at 2019, so we've moved on, what, 5-6 years, would the issues that someone like Tom Maynard was facing have been managed better than they even were in 2013? Did it take something like that to wake people up to the fact that you know, you need to be more alert for these kind of issues to be dealt with?
People are reactive. I mean, you know, obviously with Tom Maynard, I know his father, Matt. He's a contemporary, and I can't imagine what the family have gone through. I mean, absolutely desperate. I'm not saying the warning signs are there, but what I do know is that, you see, I'm a great one. I would always listen to people whose experience has sort of stemmed from the battlefield. Anything that's learnt in the classroom is obviously important, because that maybe means that people are better at presenting in front of an audience. It doesn't necessarily mean that what they're presenting is absolutely spot on. I see holes in all sorts of presentations where people are talking to an audience. I'm not saying I'm the greatest person in front of an audience, but I back my stuff, and I've done enough of it. And I've judged myself solely on feedback. What happened with Tom Maynard was preventable, very preventable. I think people sometimes are frightened to ask questions. Think you've got a problem, mate? Because I think you've got a problem, mate. And if you've actually been there yourself, and the person knows you've been there yourself, it's easier for someone to, maybe someone like myself, to go and sit in front of a player or go and ask searching questions, because I've had to ask searching questions of people, people have asked searching questions of me, and I've had to ask searching questions of myself. I've also got four kids who sometimes ask searching questions, and I'm probably the best person to ask those questions of, because I don't really care what they're seeing. I've probably seen worse. So I think I'm a fair judge. In 2019, you're always going to have situations arising. We just had one with Alex Hales. Didn't lead to death. What it led to is a situation on the eve of a World Cup, first one at home for 40 years. And you got a major player who they can't play because of an issue, you know, over a Class A drug. It's not the worst thing that could possibly happen, but in terms of the image of the game, the image of the game is always the thing that will prevail, and the player will always fall by the wayside. So I think a lot of these things are preventable. I think a lot of the things that, the way that things are gone about, as I say, everything's open to be looked at, and everything's open to look as to whether it could be put across in a better manner.
Yeah, I go along with that. Incidentally, you talked about presentations. The single best bit of advice I ever got was that no audience ever wants to see you fail. That's always worth remembering.
Unless you're an opponent of, you know.
Well, it's different if you're in a competitive situation. Exactly. If you're stood up in front of a group of people, sure, they never want to see you fail. Sure. What I would like to do, and we're certainly going to come on and talk about your time in LA and how you got there, but it would be remiss of us in this chat not to just hit on a few career highlights. And maybe just start quite early on. I mean, your dad, I think, played for Leicestershire. Your brother played here. Was cricket almost like a direction you always felt you were going to go in?
I could take you back before dad. I mean, my grandfather died on the field at the Grange, which is at the home of Scottish cricket, at the crease. The bowler ran into bowl. He was just about to bowl the ball, and my grandfather fell over straight towards point, stone cold dead. So cricket was always played in our family. My dad was a very good player. Then we had a war. He spent 10 years in the RAF, came out, played 2 years for Leicester, then got offered opportunity to go back up north, pro'd for Northumberland, pro'd in the leagues, pro'd with Rowan Canai, joint pro at Ashington, Steve Harmison's club. Yeah. So for me, I can never remember a time where we didn't have bat and ball in our hand, playing in the back lane, playing at the cricket club, playing games, practicing it. So there was David, Tony and myself. My middle brother, Tony, was also on the staff here for 2 years, 3 years maybe. So cricket would be in our blood.
Yeah. As I said in the intro, you know, give you a couple of highlights and ask you maybe to pick out a couple that really meant something to you. Clearly, the 94 treble, you were man of the match in the Lords Benson Hedges final. You did the double in 95. You were the youngest player to score 1,500 runs in a first-class season in 86. You were part of a world record of, was it eight consecutive 50-run partnerships with Andy Moles. You played in six one-day finals. And so to take the earlier theme we had around confidence and purpose, there must have been points in that career when it was really, really high and you would have felt invincible. what most comes to your mind when you look back on some of those highlights?
Well, playing in a Lords final when I was 20, my first Lords final, that was part of a highlight because I told my dad that I would play in a Lords final when I was well young. Sat in front of the telly in Newcastle watching it with my dad, and I said I'll play in a final at Lords one day. I also told him I'd get man of the match in the final one day, which I managed to pull off.
You did indeed.
Things like, we didn't mention it there, 1993 final against Sussex where we chased 322, which was the start of our run of, I think, six trophies in 24 months. That would be a highlight because we did it without Alan Donald. We didn't have an overseas player. That taught us a lot. And then, so obviously people playing cricket with people like Alan, Brian Lara, obviously Willis's and your Calatrans and your Amos's, but also playing in an era where all the greats of the world played, Viv, Joel, wherever you went, Mako, Malcolm Marshall at Hampshire, Gordon Greenidge, Sylvester Clarke, everywhere, Imran Khan, Sir Richard Hadley, the list goes on and on and on. Everywhere you played, you play against people who were household names, but also real geniuses of their trade. And they were pretty humble people, so you could actually spend a lot of time with them and learn from them.
Well, one of the, I mean, incidentally, I you took 3 for 34 at Lord's in the when you were man of the match.
Yeah.
And you made a few as well, I can't remember.
The odd nod out.
Yeah, you did. You did. And Graham Hick was one of the wickets, so that's not bad going. A Worcestershire man as well, so.
Key wicket.
Yeah.
Key wicket, always. Well,
so actually, I'm going to derail a tiny bit, because one of the other things that you talk about is the obsession with averages, which is quite interesting in a career discussion. And yours are very respectable. You know, average around 26, 27 with the bat. And I'm talking first-class cricket. Lower end of 30s with the ball. Very, very respectable. But do you feel, one of the things you said when we were chatting ahead of this discussion was a feeling that averages can be rather misleading. And you played to a certain extent in an era when, you know, wickets were more batsman friendly. You look at 94 and you can see at the top of those averages a number of players in the 90s. But nowadays you had a feeling that players are more team orientated and less obsessed with averages, more about the impact they can have on a game. And what averages in bowling, batting don't ever tell you is what particular impact did you have at absolutely key moments in a game of cricket. Football, I think, now is much better as a sport at being able to highlight the impact of a player has more than just his individual stats.
Sure. I mean, when I played, I would say that averages meant absolutely nothing. It doesn't mean a thing, in the sense that it's when you actually score your runs and when you actually take your wickets. So I would argue my corner the whole time throughout my whole career about that. Willis said to me, my job, and he said this to me when I was 16, your job is to bowl less balls to get wickets. And when you bat, your job is to put the cat amongst the pigeons. And he said that to me when I was 16. And at the time, I almost like said, thank you, Lord, because that's exactly how I thought I should play. So throughout my whole career, I mean, I would say it was only the latter stages of my career where, if you use Shane Warne as an example, if you attack, if you're an attacking bowler, you have a defensive field. What I used to get was get told to attack, and that was by nature. That's how I wanted to bowl. But I would get attacking fields. You don't want attacking fields, when you, because if you look at the bulk of my career, you see that most of my wickets were bowled LBW or caught behind. So I didn't need I didn't need five slips. I didn't need two gullies. I didn't need three short legs. I was either going to hit the stumps, hit the pads, or the keeper's going to catch it, maybe catch it first slip. Obviously, you pick up wickets in different areas as well, but by and large, that was where the bulk of my wickets came. So for most of my career, I felt my captains didn't understand me and how to get the best out of me. So any success that you have, sometimes you're even fighting the system of which you're actually playing within. So the guys that play now, obviously they understand the fact that it's not about statistics. I mean, here we are overlooking the great Edgbaston Stadium, where the wickets used to be real shirt fronts and it was a bowler's nightmare. And the batters here would be very happy if they scored 1,000 runs or 1,500 runs, because it meant they got another year on their contract. Whereas the bowlers would moan like stink, and me as a young kid would say, how come, I used to say this to Willis, you're our captain. Surely you have some say in this. You've got you've got Gladstone Small, you've got me, and all three of us can get it through at good pace. Why do we play on wickets that offer us no assistance? And he will just say, look at the batters in the team. They go and speak to the groundsman. They go and speak to the committee man. If they want games to last 3 or 4 days, then the games will last for 3 or 4 days, but we'll never get the results we think we should. And, you know, that was just the way it was. So there are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yeah, well, I think that was the point you were making there. I mean, if you look at now, it's almost the opposite issue. As you bookend the county season in sort of April and September, you don't give batsmen enough chance. It's that old thing of you go too far in one direction and then you go too far to sort of correct that. You've mentioned a couple of names and we talked a bit about Bob Willis. It would be remiss, given that, you know, your career overlapped with his. And it's interesting, one of the things you said there was about him just telling you to bowl it fast, takes it, like keeping it really simple. Kind of reminds me in a way of Mike Brearley's advice of Bob, just bowl fast, don't worry about the no balls. It was like that clarity of instruction gave you something to play to your strengths. Was that something that, one of the things that Bob Willis was particularly good at in the role he played in your career?
He would, despite the fact that we travelled a lot in car journeys to away grounds, and you'd spend a lot of time. We were lucky; we were the last generation that could probably go out and enjoy ourselves. So we could spend quite a lot of time in bars talking. Some of the greatest lessons you learn in life as a sportsman could be in a bar situation. Maybe because of the fact that you may be drinking beer and you may be relaxed and you may be, you know, sort of forget the disappointments that may have happened slightly earlier in the day on the field. But Willis was pivotal in our career. If you speak to Gladstone Small, you speak to any of the guys who were young at that time, he was the nearest that we had as a mentor. He was always very good, even, you know, right up until recently, many of us would sort of bump into him, keep in touch. Obviously, we didn't work together, so we didn't spend as much time with him as, say, the guys that worked at Sky. We lived in different cities, but I interviewed Bob three times in the last probably 3 or 4 years. He was just very good at keeping it really, really basic, and he didn't feel the need to write a page if he could. The synopsis could be done in a sentence.
Yeah, clarity of instruction is a thing that I think many coaches have.
The mere fact that sort of nearly 40 years after the time where he became prominent in my life, I remember many of the sentences that he said to me. If he'd mumbled on in the way that certain people do, where the message never really, the penny doesn't really drop, Willis should have been a poet.
Hence his love of Bob Dylan. It's the old tennis ball analogy, isn't it? If I chuck 10 at you, how many do you catch? If I chuck 1 at you, how many do you catch?
Right.
Well, unless you're... who was it who dropped that awful catch in New Zealand? That was Joe Denley, wasn't it? Yeah. Oh, that was a shocker. Anyway, so we won't dwell on that. Again, just a couple of names that come out of your career. I mean, you couldn't look at 1994 without mention of a certain BC Lara, who attracted a huge amount of media interest, obviously 501 as it would. But you're quite defensive of him in the book, in a positive way. You know, you felt, I think, that he got a lot of criticism just for being the personality that he was, but was actually far more of a team player than the outside world gave him credit for. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think when he came to us, he was 24. He was a world record holder, having beaten Cigar Field Sober's record weeks before, or days before, really. Within 5 weeks, he was a double world record holder. In a day and age where there was no protection. He was only 24. It's a guy from Trinidad who had been to England before. We'd met him before. We'd spent time with him before, socially, as well as here. Big mates with Dwight York, who was playing at Aston Villa at the time. I would say he was the epitome of a team player. You know, when people criticise him, I'd say, Christ, look at the way he plays. When he walked off, having finished his career in international cricket, what he actually shouted to the crowd was, did I entertain you? And it's a very pivotal sentence.
It's gladiatorial. Are you not entertained?
That's what he said, word for word, did I entertain you? He sees cricket as a form of entertainment. And before he came to us, many times I used to stand in the middle of this ground here or other cricket grounds, questioning whether the opponents actually thought that they were involved in entertainment or whether this was just a personal, case of they were coming out to bat and they would bat in whatever way they could, and they were after scoring runs, and if they scored runs to the detriment of their team and bored the hell out of people who had paid money to watch, it seemed irrespective in their eyes. Whereas Brian always wanted to entertain, he always wanted to take the game forward. When people criticise him and call him selfish and this, that and the other, I would say he's the epitome of being a team player. you know, and I said it then, and I would say it, I'd say it every day since. And the funny thing about it is I get asked about Brian Lara probably every day in my life.
Yeah,
and he'd always say the same things. And he got a bad rap when he was here. He wasn't protected. Jonathan Barnett was his agent. Jonathan Barnett's job is to make Brian as much money as he possibly can and himself as much money as possibly could. But there was never a constant shield around him. If Brian Lara was the superstar today on the field that he was then, he would have a posse of people around him protecting him. But he never had that.
Yep. Well, inevitably that 501 will come up. By the way, for the record, I think you got 1 for 51 in that game. Mm-hmm. It was John Morris, the famous co-pilot of the Gower biplane. He had made 200 odd by the time you got him, but you did. The other person that I wanted just to quickly touch on, because he's a friend of Guerrilla Cricket and we've had on the show a couple of times, is Gladstone Spall. You shared a house with Gladstone, didn't you?
Great.
So there must be a little story or two you can tell us about Gladstone.
I could tell you many stories about Gladstone Spall. We lived together for 3 years in Birmingham, and we probably spent 6 or 7 months living together in Melbourne. I'm not sure it was a house that Gladstone and I shared. Maybe it was the summer before our 3 years living together. I remember Gladstone, maybe it was a place we had. We had an old style kettle, which you put on a flame, not an electric one.
Yeah.
And we were having this battle as to, this is typical of young sportsmen, maybe young men as well, but we were all refusing to wash the pots and pans and the dishes up. So it was just getting higher and higher and higher in the kitchen. We even started to put them in the bath. And I remember Gladstone coming home as a single guy, as we all were at that time, and he brought a girl back for a cup of coffee from the pub across the road. And I was sat in the corner of the kitchen, and I watched Gladstone take the kettle, take the top off, go over to the tap, fill it full of water, put the top back on, put it on the flame. And I knew that I'd just cooked a tin of baked beans in that kettle. But Gladstone obviously didn't. So as he was sweet talking this young woman in the kitchen, I said, "Listen, I'm out of here. Have a pleasant evening, you two," and went up to my room and planned the rest of my evening. And then, as I was about to go out, and Gladstone about 2 minutes later shouted my name up, and he didn't have to explain. He'd obviously sort of put the coffee in the cups and begun to pour the water in, and had a load of baked beans floating on top of these. And that was the last of the milk as well. So I'd completely stuffed his evening up. But no, there's many funny. We laughed and joked, and you know, we worked hard and we played hard, as a couple of young guys. And obviously, there's many experiences on and off the field that some of which are shared, some aren't.
So I mean, let's sort of to get us onto some of the discussion about Los Angeles and some of that activity. I just wanted to sort of, as you came to the end of your career. Clearly, as we think about that whole thought about confidence and purpose that is central to the way you think about life, the way you think about coaching and mentoring and the way you played, you had it collectively and you had it individually for much of your career. And clearly through that sort of 94 season, you had it in spades. I think you played your last game at Lords in 96.
Yep.
Yeah. By the way, you caught Tufnell, bowled Fraser. And there you go. Tufnell, what a way to go.
and Philip Tufnell would tell you to this day, if he'd had that catch to take 100 times, he would drop it 99 times out of 100. Yeah, it was quite remarkable. Never has a cricket ball been hit so far up in the air at Lord's Cricket Ground for someone like Philip Tufnell to be stood underneath it. And for him to catch it was remarkable. Yeah, happy times. And it was somewhat ironic that I finished my career at Lord's Cricket Ground, where it had all started as an MCC young cricketer so many years before. So Lord's has many, many, to this day, it has so many memories.
So there's sort of the more serious question I was coming on to was, as we got to 96, at what point, was there a single defining point where you thought to yourself, I just don't want to do this anymore? Did it creep up on you, take you by surprise, or did you kind of think, had other things in life started to deflect and distract that you weren't quite sure, and there it was as a surprise?
Once Bob Woolmer had left here, I knew it was only going to go downhill. I think that the more successful you become, the more doors open. Some of the doors that opened were ones that hopefully wouldn't be open to other people. That I'm thinking the negative doors there. Some of the other doors that opened were things like the opportunity to go and spend time in America and explore that not only as a country, but also the potential to go and do work there. So I would say that really Bob leaving September 1994, that was a stage where I'd achieved everything that I'd set out to achieve. 95 was a formality, really, in terms of results. We turned up pre-season. We trained hard. We had the season that we did. Did a double. In theory, if we'd argued on a technicality, that should really have been another treble as well. So really, by the end of 1995, I turned up in 1996. It's not a happy summer for me. I didn't really want to be around. I didn't think that I'd seen better coaching, I'd seen better this, I'd seen better that, and really my eyes were elsewhere.
So is it, I mean, this in the book, this is where you sort of talked about the euphoria of the mid-90s being emotionally challenging. If you sort of take that euphoria, those peaks that you reached, and then the fact that things were not quite the same, you kind of, it's like a bit of a perfect storm then, because at the same time there's stuff going on in your own life that's distracting, and it sort of ground to a halt a bit, didn't it? Just before we go on to talk us a little bit maybe through how you went from that very challenging period to starting to move life forward again, and some of the amazing work that you then went and did with the Prince's Trust, Cricket Without Boundaries, etc.
You talk about euphoria. As someone who's always been a petrol head and always had American cars, I went to Houston, Texas, walked into a Dodge dealership and walked out with a V10 Dodge Viper, two-seater sports car, 8,000 cc's, and drove it from Houston to LA. That was pretty euphoric. And that's a car that I had for 18 months. I mean, it seems a pretty crazy sort of, you know, to go from being a professional sportsman or whatever. I wanted to put to bed everything that, if you like, given me my name. I wanted to go to a country, be totally anonymous. I spent time in Houston. I lived with three women.
Not at the same time.
Well, all three of them were there. Oh, right. All three of them were there at all times. They studied at the University of Austin. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when they were in class, I would go and sit in the library on the campus and sit. And basically, I studied funding. Or I would look and speak to people who worked in that library. I'd talk about funding, how you could fund certain activities in America. The extremes were greater. You talk about gang life. That was fascinating. Talk about homelessness. There's 300 million people in America, so there's more guns. There's more homelessness. There's more gangs. And these things were incredibly visual. Maybe because I was a stranger in town, it was more obvious to me. Other things that people took for granted, rough parts of town, they bypassed those places. I didn't. I drove straight through them. I walked through them at times. It was the start of a huge adventure for me. And I would be in and out of the States, you know, back in this country. If I was going to be able to see my kids, I would come back and I would hopefully see them. Sometimes I came back and I wasn't able to see them, and I would jump back straight back on the next plane and go back to the States. It was almost like having gypsy residence, really. Like, you know, I had a bag over my shoulder and I just went. When I got back to Houston, I had an 8-liter, 2-liter sports car, which I could cruise around in. I had a purpose, but to the outside world, people probably thought I was drifting. But I was there. I looked at exactly what I knew. I knew that what I'd been involved in off the field, in townships and in coaching, and having had the creme de la creme of coaches, if you like, in Bob Woolmer, plus in theory, he's a psychologist as well as anything else, much more beyond bat and ball. With the education I had, I didn't have an ECB level, whatever, coaching badge, but if you sent an ECB coach into those environments, they wouldn't last 2 minutes. I had a much better chance because A, I didn't look like a coach. B, I think I had a fair understanding of people and how to communicate with them. And once they knew that you were genuine, certain places they thought that you were a narc, they thought you were an undercover cop. And once I'd persuaded them that I would spend most of my life trying to avoid undercover cops, that you had them on your side, and then you start to open doors, and then the real adventure starts, which obviously further down the road led to sort of being invited to go and spend time in LA and to go back to South Africa and coach.
How the sequence of events that kind of took you there, and then some of the experiences, is something I wanted to sort of really make sure that we talked about, because it's a long old way from Lord's Final to the street gangs of Compton, South Central, and Inglewood. And which kind of came first? Because you've done a lot of work here that led to the sort of the Prince's Trust Association.
Sure.
Then I think you talked about was it Ted Hayes? Have I got the name right?
Ted Hayes.
And you ended up, as I say, with you know the Crips and the Bloods, and you're right there at the front line of the worst of LA gangland, teaching them cricket and using cricket as a force to turn around lives. That's a chasm that you've leapt. Tell us how you got there.
What actually happened? I sat with a guy called Tim Watts, who was the chairman of Pertemps Group. So Pertemps are a recruitment company, and I'd known Tim since probably when I very first came here, 16, 17. He had a hospitality suite here, and we would come in and drink beer with him at the end of play. And right at the very end of my career, I remember sitting with him in his office in Meriden, and he said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't want to be a coach. I don't want to be a teacher, but I think there's a role in between." And he said, "Go away, get some experience, come back to me and talk to me. See if there's a way that we can sort of merge and see what we can do." And pretty much immediately after that, I went and spent some time in America. As I said, I spent time in a university library and came up with the name of Cricket Without Boundaries. And the idea was to try and take a sport into places where they didn't know what it was, but link sport to education to lead to employment. So it would, in a way, it would fit.
This was in America.
The idea came to me, and in a way, unofficially, I worked with a small group of people. And then I didn't have a recruitment company at the end of it waiting to try and get these people back into work. But it was the art of positive thinking. Mm. If I could do something unofficially and people would turn up, the more they turned up, it would improve them as people, because they would get used to turning up because there was an activity taking place. Most people do that because it's a place of work. This was just an activity which would maybe do something for an hour a day. If they turned up regularly, they would have fun. They may bring more people. There would be positives that would come from it. I came back to the UK to see my kids, sat with Tim in his office in Meriden, and I said, "This is what I would like to do." We then formed two companies. One was called Coachright, which was to try and target kids in schools that had difficulties, and link sport to academic accreditation, so that would be key skills accreditation. So as long as we could prove that learning was taking place through sport, those kids would get key skills accreditation.
So this was after the initial LA experience?
Actually took place in Houston.
Oh, right.
So we formed a company called Coachright. We also formed a company called Cricket Without Boundaries, where we work with the long-term unemployed. So the unemployed had to be unemployed for over 4.5 years because that was the only funding available to us. I spoke to Dennis Amos here, who was the chief executive, and put forward the proposition that we use the indoor school and they become part of that partnership, which they did. And we ran schemes where we would put anything from between 12 and 15 people who'd been unemployed for 4.5 years through, it could be a 12-week program, it could be a 6-week program, what it meant was that in the indoor school here, which had just been built, which was hardly being used by the community, all of a sudden half of the sports hall and the classroom was being used for 40 weeks of the year, minimum. So we ran that. It was hugely successful, as was the Coach Wright scheme. At one stage, anything up, I think, between 4,000 and 4,500 kids a week were getting coaching. And it was linked to academic accreditation. So it moved them forward in lots of different ways. What it also did is it put a coach, it added an additional teacher to each school at a time where teachers were being pulled out of school because of lack of funding. So those two companies were set up. They ran. I mentored all the coaches, because an ECB qualified coach wouldn't be the best person to deliver those programs. It was solely about the art of communication, and you had to be covered in other areas, things like insurance and stuff like that. So we weren't necessarily looking for cricket coaches. We were looking for people with excellent communication skills who got their audience, who knew the problems that they were going through. So I set all that up, ran it for some time, went to the States after that. Those companies ran for 10 years. I was back in Houston, and a woman called Katie Haber, who's a movie director, she contacted me from LA.
She was involved in Sam Peckinpah in some capacity, wasn't she?
Sam Peckinpah's long-term partner, but Sam had passed away some time before I appeared on the scene. You had a woman, an English Rose, who lived in West Hollywood, who asked me what I was up to. We had this long discussion. She told me about this cricket team she was trying to progress. They were based in Compton. She had formed this team with a political activist for the homeless called Ted Hayes.
Is this the Homies and the Pops?
So initially the team was called Homies and Pops, yeah. Okay. Initially it was called Compton Cricket, Crickets. So anyway, they had this team. Katie asked me if I would get involved. I went and spent time there. The idea really for me was to progress this team to try and get funding from something like the ICC, whether that be from ICC Central, an additional pot, or through, because obviously the ICC put money into American cricket. It's a very small amount of money. Really for a country the size of the United States of America. So it would then be centralized, which would be California, which would be even smaller sum of money. What I was saying to the ICC, we'd speak to presidents, we'd speak to prime ministers in this country, use them as an example of kids in gangs, moving them out of gangs, because really it comes down to something as simple as, if you can get hold of a group of people who are consistently in trouble, if you can take them away from that area, say for 8 to 9 hours a day or at a weekend, at least you knew when you were with them they weren't getting into trouble. And the police would also know that. And so the idea was to teach them a sport, keep them out of trouble, try and structure their lives so that at any time of the day, if they were in trouble, they could pick up a phone and someone would go pick them up and take them into a different part of town. Because you're talking about life, and, well, death is easy come, easy go there. Guns are carried like people carry mobile phones. So cricket was the thing that would draw them, in a way, because it was the most visual side of it, but the psychological side of it was to move them into employment or to keep them out of the system. Sometimes it was a matter of speaking to judges to try and keep them out of jail. It was about trying to educate young people about what they actually knew about. They were very good. They knew what gangs were. They knew what the thing is. It's very difficult if you're sat in front of a kid who earns $1,500 a day selling drugs and say, don't do that, son, do this, go to college, do this, where they earn not 1 cent. Something normally had to happen in order for those kids to turn their lives, and often it would be the loss of a brother, a sister, something that would happen right in front of them. Sometimes it would be a case where a copper would take him around the corner and do what a copper shouldn't do, which is pin him up against the wall and say, listen, mate, unless you change your life, you'll never see daylight ever again. So, you know, the cops play a big part in that. I think little things that people don't understand is if you go and work in those environments and you say, right, we can get our hands on money. And I knew how to get our hands on money because I understood the funding streams. Mm-hmm. But the biggest problem was you couldn't, no one would ever tell you where they lived. So you didn't have zip codes, you didn't have postcodes. You couldn't sit down and say, right, Fred Smith lives in Compton and this is his zip code. You couldn't do things like that because no one would ever give their addresses out because no one, it wasn't in your best interest. So what you have to do is you have to speak to police forces and say things like, when we put on activities, less kids get shot, can we talk? And they would know that that would be the case anyway. So you get letters of references from police forces, you get letters of reference from community leaders, you get letters of reference, and you just have to build a profile that indicates that good work is taking place.
So, I mean, again, the way you portray it in the book is fascinating. Linking that, you know, some of those challenges back to cricket, I'm just trying to imagine in my mind's eye, you know, you talk about, you know, players that you've coached, you know, being shot literally the day when you've just finished coaching them. You know, you talk about Execution Junction, the frequency of funerals, and, you know, I mean, harrowing stories. I'm just trying to picture how you take kids in that environment or young people, and suddenly or probably not suddenly, they're playing cricket. And although cricket is the means to an end, it's not the end. It's a complex game to get people to get somehow.
Ultimately, it's about gaining people's trust. I mean, what is more frightening, facing the quickest bowler in the world in a game of cricket in front of 30,000 people, or walking into a crack den in South Central Los Angeles and hanging around and people don't quite know why you're there? But ultimately, it's about, I mean, you know, I've seen a million people do crack. You know, it happens in all sorts of walks of life, well, from the biggest houses that you could ever drive by to the biggest dumps in terms of, you know, parts of town. It happens in all sorts of environments. So if you have to gain people's trust, you know, people, I would be called a ball player in America. That not many people knew what cricket was. But I was a professional sportsman. That was my background. I was different. I didn't turn up in a tracksuit. I was still young enough where I could actually demonstrate I could bowl a ball with speed and I could hit the ball miles. My eyes were still good. So I was a bit different. The fact that I was also willing to go into places, parts of town that other people didn't go, that might have intrigued certain people as well. But I mean, for me, we have the freedom of the land. It's not like South Africa, where if you're a certain colour, you can't go into certain parts of town. In virtually every country I've been in the world, I've always thought, the tourist bits never really interested me. If I wanted to see Disneyland, I could go to Disneyland. I've spent loads of time in America. Disneyland would not interest me in the slightest. However, the you know, sort of West Hollywood, Sunset Strip, that would interest me because of the history of it. The gangland areas were absolutely fascinating. And if you talk about that period of life, you talk about people like Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls, and it's a huge era within hip-hop music. There was a lot of activity going on. It was a great time. It was a great time to be an observer. I'm not sure it was a great time to be a local. So to be able to have the possibility of going in and doing good work and showing what... The biggest disappointment for me regarding the United States of America is that Katie Haber and Ted Hayes started something up. I was involved in it. Nick Compton came in slightly further down the line, probably a bit further down the line. But despite the fact that I wrote to David Cameron here in this country and said, you've got a huge problem with gangs in this country. If anything... all my travels far and wide, if ever there's a group of individuals who should come, spend time in this country, go in front of young people up and down this country and talk about what gang life really is like, because in this country, it's toy town. in comparison to what I saw in the United States of America or I've seen in South Africa. Yes, a lot of people get knived here. A lot of people get shot here. Of course, there are problems with gangs, but the numbers and what's at stake in the States was so much higher. We wrote to Cameron, Katie and I. We wrote to the President of the United States. Arnold Schwarzenegger and his department were very good. They found ways of supporting it in different ways. Sometimes it would be a case of finding money to bury kids that there was no money to bury them. But we wrote to all sorts of people. The ICC, no one would put money into it. And then somewhat ironically, was the last letter that Katie and I wrote to David Cameron. He didn't reply to it initially, so I then resent the letter to 10 Downing Street and said, this is the letter that we sent to you 3 weeks ago or whatever it was. Can you acknowledge it? And is there any way that you can assist us? We were actually asking for $70,000, the equivalent of $70,000 US. And because of the work that I'd done here in this country, I knew people up and down this country and still do. And from London, people were saying, it's going to kick off in London in a big, big way. And it was linked to a guy that had been shot in Tottenham. Mm-hmm. And we wrote to Cameron. We said we think that this should actually take place. We had a sponsor to bring him into this country, which we lost right at the very last moment, which meant that Katie and I wrote to David Cameron, said there is a problem in this country regarding gangs. These group of people from LA were due to arrive here. We've lost our sponsor. Is there any way you can point us in the direction of or organize payment to get them here, equivalent to $70,000 US, which I think was 50,000 sterling at the time. He told me to write to the, he after ignoring the first letter, it wasn't he who replied to the second letter. The letter said we should speak to Warwickshire County Cricket Club and we should speak to the English Cricket Board, which shows that you may go to Eton, but it doesn't mean you're the brightest kid on the block. What it actually meant was they completely misunderstood what we were, the angle that we were actually coming from. And within days, you had the riots up and down this country, both in London, Manchester, Liverpool, certainly Birmingham here. That would be one of the biggest disappointments of my post-career.
And yet you describe your time in LA. You describe your time in LA as, you said, of all the activities I've been attached to, I believe this was the one which could have opened up cricket to a massive non-playing audience. Right. Sounds to me like the government here was seeing it as a cricket proposition. You were seeing it as a social proposition which could have strong, tangible results, of which cricket was a route.
This was a community activity. Yeah. It wasn't a cricket activity. This was all my work post-career is about moving people forward. The fact that I have a background in cricket is neither here nor there. And sometimes, because I have a background in cricket, that's made it the most obvious way in order to apply for funding. But ultimately, the outcome is for a better world.
Yep. Yeah. So kind of different to the problem, you know, because one of the thoughts I was toying with, I look at what the ECB does with its All Stars initiative, which I think has Asmar Ghazali, who's just up the road from King's Heath, you know, looking at ways you attract people to the game. But that, in a way, having thought it through now, that's a different problem. So one is attract people to cricket, and that I'd like to tap your brain on just for as we move towards a close. But equally, using cricket simply as a force to improve, enrich and offer people a route to better life is kind of a different problem. So let's take one of those. And we talked about it a little bit earlier. That experience that you have in terms of coaching cricket as a form of life skill is a very unique skill in terms of the type of person that can do it. If you were to put a purely round peg into a round hole, you'd see cricket and you go, it's a cricket coach's job. What are the assets that somebody really needs to use cricket as the force, but to work with the kind of communities where what you're actually doing is improving employment opportunities or turning around, drug ruined lives to see a future. That's a very unique skill set. Just try and encapsulate a bit what it takes to be that person.
You have to have a very open mind. You haven't got to be judgmental. You just have to see the best way forward. Sometimes you're not the best person to take these people forward, but if you have real knowledge of the neighborhood, you'll know who the best people are to move these things forward. You have to have very good communication skills, and you have to prove to them that you are there to help them. And if you can do that, then a game called cricket will benefit from it. But ultimately, it's about people. We're sat here, three of us are sat here now. It's three people having a discussion where we're not just talking about cricket, we're talking about many other things as well. Whereas if we went across into the pavilion now, you might bring someone who has a background like me of professional sport, but they wouldn't be able to talk about the range of things or experiences that we are. So just because the same person can put the same tracksuit on doesn't mean they're going to be able to do the same job. Exactly. So it then comes down to, does the person that's going to go in, is he the right person? Because you can have a load of badges, but that isn't going to gain the respect of people. It's about what's sat in front of them. Like I said earlier, I deal with people. I don't care if you're the chief executive or the chairman or the guy that cleans the bins in the stadium. It doesn't worry me. It's about being a decent person. So if you can see that there is potential to improve, then all you're actually looking for is that person to believe that they can improve as well. So if they can turn their life around, they've got to actually believe that they can. So if you have to sell that to them and tell them that you have been in these very same situations yourself, so they're not to be feared, because hopefully you're visually an improved version of how they interpret their own problems. So it's about manning up and finding out who is the best person. Sometimes you are the best person to go in there, try and get them to believe in that you are actually there to help them and their community. Cricket will benefit from that. And that's pretty much it.
Well, and through that philosophy, you have worked with the Prince's Trust. You get the US Certificate of Appreciation, which I think you say was your proudest award, more than necessarily winning trophies at Lord's. Just going to close with chucking some of your own words back at you a wee bit. A happy ending, you say, is just a story with a missing chapter.
Right.
Life is a work in progress with opportunities that you intend to grab. So as we look forward, Paul, what are some of the opportunities you're looking to grab as we move from today to the next chapter of where you're taking the Paul Smith life?
What I'm looking to do as we speak is all the experiences that I have, all the work that I've been involved in, look to effectively set up a business and put the whole thing under one banner. Top and tail a few things, throw a few areas that I've worked in the past aside, and really focus on things from a business perspective, and start writing one book, maybe two books, and then work out how you would actually go about distributing that, whether that's audio books, whether it's self-publishing, whether it's go to a distributor, whether it's whatever. So life is pretty exciting, to be fair.
We have many philosophies in the way that you've talked today that are quite in tune with the guerrilla way of thinking, as far as we're concerned. Your final words again, has it been worth it? Categorically, yes. How do you put a price on intervening in a life headed in the wrong direction and turning it around? That's a pretty glowing endorsement for what you've been doing. I hope you continue to find ways to do it. Thank you for your hospitality and for your time, Paul Smith. It's been a pleasure.
It's very kind.
From Gloucestershire to Leicestershire, up into the stratosphere. Grab yourself a can of beer. Countyman, lend us a hand.
Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.